This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Nally. Our guest this week is Chandler Gould, CEO of the National Association of Wheat Growers. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the Modern Ag Alliance. Learn more at controlweedsnotfarming.com. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with NOG's Chandler Gould next. Trial lawyers are using a discredited report from a World Health Organization sub-agency to attack a safe, American-made weed-fighting tool. This tool helps keep your food costs down, and without it, food inflation could double. Stand with American farmers and keep trial lawyers' greed out of our farms and food supply. Fight back at controlweedsnotfarming.com. Paid for by the Modern Ag Alliance. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. The process of budget reconciliation in the House of Representatives has yielded proposed changes to farm and nutrition programs as well as tax policy. The battle lines of that debate remain in the Budget and Rules Committee and still very much in question. Chandler Gould, CEO of the National Association of Wheat Growers, says Chairman Thompson of the Ag Committee delivered proposals wheat farmers need.
Well, there's definitely several good things that came out of the House markup this week through the reconciliation process. And clearly, NOG's goals and priorities are throughout the entire farm bill and are beyond just Title IV, the SNAP program. And the fact that we are in a third-year extension of a farm bill, and its cost of production has continued to rise, you know, the current bill that we're operating under just simply does not meet the need of our growers. And so if the only way we are going to be able to move pieces of the farm bill so that it accurately reflects and supports and provides risk management for wheat growers is through reconciliation, then that's what we're going to have to do. And so the increase in payment limits, the increase in the market promotion programs, and the positive changes to crop insurance are all in that bill, and we are going to continue to support those priorities. But also, you know, there's some things that don't fit in reconciliation, like, you know, Fair and Labeling Act, or to making sure that FFRA is being implemented and recognized for the federal law that it is for state preemption, and also looking at food aid and how much of the commodities or how much of the commodities go into that program. So there's some other important things that we were not able to consider during reconciliation. And so we'll have to figure out how to keep the good things in there moving forward as it goes through the budget process. But then how do we get the orphan or left out items that NOG supports across that finish line? And that strategy is still to be determined.
Well, there was a period of time, and I'm going back to the older days of Congress, when there would have been a lot of votes. There would have been a lot of pieces of legislation, and now it seems like there are very few vehicles, and all kinds of things are attached to that train. I was in the room speaking with Chairman Thompson of the House Ag Committee when he said, you know, we're going to get a down payment, and that's what he was talking about with reconciliation on the farm bill. We're going to get a down payment here, and then later in the year, we want to come back and do the rest of the farm bill. We want to be able to get the rest of it done. And I applaud his enthusiasm, but I wonder, are there enough vehicles moving, and is there enough political will to do the rest of these things that do need to be done?
Yeah, Jeff, that is the question. Like, are the items that have been left out, is the constituency base large enough to move a bill through two chambers and to the president with those items? And I definitely think out of the Ag Committee under Chairman Thompson's leadership and Ranking Member Craig's, absolutely. But do I think that there's enough to get it across the House and Senate floor? I honestly don't know. And then you've also got to look at that narrow margin you've got in the House, which has caused a problem just today in the Budget Committee. Trying to get any bill out of the House with that narrow margin and with several of the ultra conservatives, I think is going to be not problematic for the orphan programs out of the farm bill, but continue to just be a problem in general of getting legislation through both chambers.
So you have at least some of the core of the farm safety net provisions in the House reconciliation that, as I understand now, will go over to the Budget Committee where all of the reconciliation proposals will come together into that one big bill. So it appears to me that whether it's the farm programs or those elements under Ways and Means with regard to taxes that are certainly much needed, how much debate will come along the way that these could be amended in the lower chamber before they go to the upper chamber?
Well, that'll come out. We won't know the answer to that until they can get it out of the budget committee. And then it'll have to go through the rules committee, and whether or not they're going to allow an open amendment process on the House floor. And honestly, you know, I used to try to make predictions on things like this, and I'm going to kind of save myself a little skin. I don't know what they'll do if they get it out of the budget committee. I mean, with that narrow margin and then coming down there because there are specific cuts that had to be made in order to pay for, you know, other programs that are in the big, beautiful bill. And so if you did an open amendment process down on the House floor, a lot of that could be changed and moved around. And so I'm going to guess that if this does get out of the budget committee, there's going to be a very narrow rule that would take it to the floor, which would limit debate and would limit the ability to amend this. And then, of course, it would be sent to the Senate, who's actually got different sets of instructions for reconciliation. So we could be looking at two very different bills as they pass out of each chamber that'll have to be conferenced and agreed to.
So that takes me to the next point, and you brought it up yourself. I was speaking with last week on this program, as a matter of fact, Senator Bozeman, you know, and I said on your side, you've got $1 billion to cut, and on the other side, they've got $230 billion. Well, the House has come up, Ag Committee, as I see, $290-300 billion that they've cut. Mr. Bozeman said they would do more than $1 billion, but obviously there's a lot of margin between $1 billion and $300 billion. And the question is, where is the final number? And wherever that final number is that enough to satisfy the Freedom Caucus and the ultra-conservatives on the nation's budget?
Yeah, that is the billion-dollar question, actually. I was going to say the million, but that is the billion-dollar question right there. I mean, if Chairman Bozeman and them, let's say, cut $10 billion, that is still a significant difference than the $295 billion that the House cut. And when you're trying to reconcile those bills and pay for those tax cuts, I think it's also going to come down to, on the Senate side, what committees are going to have those larger cuts and to come to that agreement. And that's going to be difficult because the Senate's also in a different situation. You've got a lot of Senate Republicans that cannot afford to cut the SNAP program as much as some House District Republicans can. And that's always been the dynamic in the Farm Bill. And if you think back to several Farm Bills in the past where they've tried to separate SNAP from the Farm Bill and it'll pass the House and then it fails in the Senate. So there's definitely a different dynamic in the upper chamber. And it's going to be very difficult, to do a straight-up partisan vote on reconciliation if SNAP is going to be a major piggy bank over there because you've got Southern Republican senators that need that program.
So, Chandler, let's hang policy. Let's keep it on the corner of the desk, but let's expand just a little bit and talk about your farmers and their economic plight right now. It's been well documented that corn and soybean producers are in a tough spot. Commodity prices down, input costs up, questions about export sales and domestic demand, tremendous headwinds, so much that with the lack of a farm bill, Congress in December of last year approved $10 billion that was in the ECAP program. Where are wheat producers now? Are you in the same boat with the others, or is there any better situation for you?
You know, honestly, we're definitely in the same boat with the others. And I would even say we've even got a little more difficult of a time because corn and soy are very fortunate to have so many additional delivery points that their products can go to, whether they're being ground up into meal or going into some type of renewable oil, cooking oil production, or heading towards renewable fuels. So granted, trade and everything else and the price has definitely affected them. But, you know, when you hop over here to the wheat industry where we're a food grain, you know, we're either going to a mill or to a food processor or being exported. If we're being fed to livestock, then you know our price is extremely low. So we're experiencing all those same problems, high input costs, lower commodity prices, and then with fewer delivery points, I actually could think I could safely say that our wheat growers have a little more difficult of a time right now as we continue to move through this troubled economic time in rural America.
Okay, so now let's add on the $21 billion that also came for disaster assistance. Is that being regulated? Is that being managed at the USDA in a way that can find it to your producers who not only have suffered economically, but also did suffer disasters?
Yes, it is. Now, it's a little bit state by state. I've got some growers that have already gone in and signed up and have received their assistance, and others are much further behind. But I am not getting calls about it, so that is a good sign. We definitely appreciate Secretary Rollins, fast-tracking that and realizing the importance of that to help our farmers through this gap stop as we continue to wait for a comprehensive farm bill or a farm bill that actually strengthens that safety net to reflect not only our current situation, but the current cost of production. So, yes, we're very thankful for that program and the way that it's being implemented, and hope some of the states that are lagging back can speed that process up, because, matter of fact, I was on my officer call yesterday, and I mean, I had two on tractors while they were sitting there talking. So it's definitely needed and appreciated, and hopefully we can come out of this and won't need more economic assistance as we look towards putting these farm bill programs together.
As a former farmer, a farm kid that's now working in media and agriculture media, I have to say it's not a story that I enjoyed telling of the reconciliation process in the House, where you're talking about cutting nutrition programs and you're talking about buffering the farm safety net. But I would enter a comment that Senator Hoeven offered last year when I met with him. He said the SNAP program is tied to inflation, and there have been increases along the way, but the farm program, the safety net, not tied to inflation. So producers have been exposed to this tremendous turn in the economy, and they are left with, you could call it a safety net, but it doesn't cover the cost of production. And Chandler, that's a dangerous situation, and it's hard to explain in a 30-second news story on a newscast.
Absolutely. I mean, the SNAP program is a vital program for rural America and helping those U.S. Citizens who are in need. And NOG has always supported SNAP. But the fact that they are indexed towards the cost of operation and cost of living and things along those lines does mean that that program gets plussed up as well as your benefits. And when you look at the farm safety net, we have not really changed reference prices at all since 2002. Yes, it does have an escalator in there, but when you just look since 2018 to now, how much the cost of production has gone up, clearly that safety net has not kept up, and you can only stress farmers over so many years where they are not turning a profit from the market before we're going to see considerable consolidation into larger farms. And we've seen it before in the 80s, and we've seen it before in the late 2000s, and we want to do everything we can to avoid that. Farmers want to receive their money from the marketplace, and when the marketplace isn't providing it, the government needs to have an efficient risk management tool backing them, and that comes in the form of a farm bill.
Well, there are a number of crops that we raise in the country, too many for me to go through those now, but if I just think about cotton and rice, corn, wheat, and soybeans, commonly producers, and grain sorghum as well, producers are looking at which ones of those crops would provide them the better return on investment. And it's not uncommon for them to shift acres based on crops that show a better outlook. But as you mentioned, for wheat, with your limited sources of market, there is a race for acres, and wheat has to keep up. So if the program doesn't provide a safety net and the market doesn't provide a safety net, it looks like that puts you in a very difficult situation.
Wheat definitely has additional headwinds that the other commodities do not have. And I'm going to take it even a step further and to make sure that I'm very clear, NOG has always and always will support renewable fuel programs. It is good for the environment. It is good for rural America. It is good for our farmers. Unfortunately, our little wheat kernel doesn't have enough sugar in it and enough of anything in it for us to be a viable commodity for a renewable to fuel type program. And when then you stack on SAF, like sustainable aviation fuel, and the commodities of, you know, winter canola and camelina that they're looking at for that program, you're really starting to walk right across what has traditionally been the wheat belt in the United States. And then when you look at more limited delivery points throughout the market, you're exactly right. Growers are going to start looking at where is the wider margin, where can I possibly take more of a hit but still be able to make it, and how are we going to divide these acres? And this isn't news to anybody, but wheat has lost acres over the last 10 to 15 years, and if we don't either find additional uses for wheat or to make sure that we've got a proper safety net behind them, I think wheat acres are in the crosshairs of many important decisions, and unfortunately, I'm worried it's not going to be plant more wheat.
Producers of corn, soy, and other crops that are not necessarily considered the food crop that wheat is have had the opportunity to lower the cost of production and increase productivity with technology and seed technology. Wheat is in a class of its own there and draws additional scrutiny from consumers not only in the U.S. but around the globe. That's also been a headwind.
100%. And I like to call it gene technology now, because we've got so many things out there available to commodity groups that are ways that you can increase disease resistance or increase drought tolerance and things along those lines. And the fact that we export 50% of our wheat to sensitive markets in the Asian Pacific realm and to Europe, and the consumer here in the U.S. who we still need to continue to educate on the safety of gene technology is going to be critical to whether or not wheat can continue to remain competitive and stay competitive for those acres. And as the climate continues to change, we are going to have to find ways to be more resilient in our industry. And yes, hybrid wheat is a solution, but that is still a slower process than if we were actually able to adopt gene technology like our soy and corn farmers have been able to do. So definitely something we need to consider, and it has caused wheat to fall behind in our ability to keep up in that race.
So Chandler, let's step out in the deep water for just a moment. The trade platform of the nation might have been said prior to the Trump administration wasn't fair, and this administration has taken action. The question is it the right action? And how do wheat growers see the situation we're in, and what do you hope for now?
Well, you know, we've gone through so many years and administrations, both Democrat and Republican, that were free trade, and we saw a lot of movement and momentum in those directions. And then, you know, under both Biden and now the Trump administration taking very different aspects towards how to fix that problem. The concern that I always have is not only do we export 50% of our wheat, luckily China is not our number one market, but Mexico is, and so far wheat has not been put on their retaliatory list back towards the U.S., and as the Trump administration continues to figure out exactly what their strategy is going to be, we monitor that very closely. But what worries me the most is if we do put tariffs on a country and leave them there, they are almost always going to retaliate on agricultural products, because agriculture is in every senator's district or state and is almost in every member of the House of Representatives. And it's an easy target that it can affect a very large constituency when you're trying to make your point. And so whether we're talking about steel and aluminum or auto parts or microchips, it's what is the country that we're doing that to going to do back to the U.S. and those retaliatory tariffs? That's where I get very concerned, especially when you're talking about something as important as a food grain like the wheat industry provides.
Is it worth it?
It is worth it if it's going to make things better on both sides. The question is, how long does the U.S. producer have to endure the pain, and how much of their own equity do they have to burn through? And will they still be here when the solution or the hope for outcomes arrive? And I'm not a smart enough person to do that calculation for you, but I worry that if this goes on too long, we could lose growers.
Chandler, I'm going back to a press release in mid-March of the life cycle assessment of the environmental benefits of wheat production. You have faced some challenges within the regulatory structure for wheat, whether a cover or in other avenues. What does the life cycle assessment say about your crop, and what should it say to policymakers in Washington and those who implement those laws?
We were very excited to get our life cycle assessment back. We had Texas A&M was our primary researcher with Colorado State. And, you know, we've been on the Hill for years saying we know we've got a good story. We know we have good water use. We know we've helped reduce erosion. We know that we have had fewer passes over the field, so that means less, you know, fuel. But now we've actually got a study that proves all of that. And over the last 20 years, we have seen a reduction in water, a reduction in land use, but an increase in yield, and also a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions and environmental impacts. And so what that says is we have become better wheat growers on less land with higher yields. Precision agriculture works. Technology through those areas has advanced us even further. And then what that also says to our trading partners like the EU, who many of them are going to start looking at what is your climate impact on how your product is grown, is going to become a negotiating factor. And we can now demonstrate that wheat has made significant improvements over the last 20 years and that we need to continue to invest in whether it be in technology or in production practices to move that ball even further, because we're going to have to continue to figure out how to produce not less, but more food on less land and hopefully have smaller environmental impacts across the board.
It's always great to have Chandler Gould with us of the National Association of Wheat Growers, extensive experience on Capitol Hill, being in the gap between producers and between leaders in Washington. Chandler, thanks for taking time in a busy week to have conversation with us here on these tough issues. You've been here before. You know it's open mic, and today you know you've got the last word.
Well, Jeff, I just want to thank you and your entire team for the opportunity and reaching out to the wheat growers. We are unique. We are the largest food grain in the United States, and we don't just feed the United States. We feed a large part of the world with what we produce. And I just want to, you know, remind everybody that and our politicians, but and also our growers and our consumers, we produce a safe product. We produce a valuable product, but we cannot let the policies and the politics in this country overshadow the largest food grain here in the United States. I would just be mortified if we lost the wheat industry here in the U.S., just like we did the oat industry. So if you want to see the path I'm worried that we're on, it is pushing this wheat industry into Canada, because we are giving economic advantages to other commodities for good reasons, like renewable fuels. Please don't overlook us as the wheat growers. We're a vital part of our community, for the agriculture, and feeding the world.
Our thanks to Chandler Gould, CEO of the National Association of Wheat Growers, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by the Modern Ag Alliance. Learn more at controlweedsnotfarming.com. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Daly.